The leader of ISIL is killed in a U.S. operation in Syria. President Joe Biden called it a major blow to global terrorism. But how much of a threat does ISIL pose now? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. The U.S. says it has eliminated one of the biggest terrorist threats to the world. The leader of ISIL blew himself up as U.S. special forces surrounded his compound in Idlib province in Syria. Not much is known about Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qurayshi, but he's believed to have directed a 10-day prison siege in northeast Syria last month. That was one of the biggest ISIL attacks since the group was declared defeated in 2019. Our White House correspondent Kimberly Halkett has more.
This horrible terrorist leader is no more.
In an address to the nation from the Roosevelt Room of the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden spoke about the operation he ordered that killed the ISIL leader, Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qurayshi.
And I directed the Department of Defense to take every precaution possible to minimize civilian casualties. Knowing that this terrorist had chosen to surround himself with families, including children, we made a choice to pursue a special forces raid at a much greater risk than to our own people, rather than targeting him with an airstrike.
As U.S. special forces moved in, the ISIL leader reportedly detonated an explosive.
In a final act of desperate cowardice, he chose to blow himself up, taking several members of his family with him.
The mission happened Thursday in northwestern Syria in Idlib province. Residents on the ground said at least 13 people, including children, were killed in the operation. The Pentagon said there were no troop casualties.
Mr. President,
Biden, his vice president, and national security advisors oversaw the mission from the Situation Room of the White House. It was the biggest U.S. raid in Syria since the 2019 operation that killed ISIL leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
This operation was literally months in the planning.
The U.S. targeted the ISIL leader for threats he allegedly posed to U.S. interests and crimes committed in Iraq in 2014, including the enslavement of Yazidi women. The raid comes a week after the defense secretary ordered the U.S. military to do more to protect civilians in combat operations, often largely forgotten in the West.
For Syrians, maybe the only silver lining of this is it has brought back media's attention to the conflict in Syria. It seems from their perspective that no one really cares. So one advantage, in a sense, is that this has now brought Syria back into the news.
Despite efforts to limit casualties, some members of Congress are now calling for an investigation into the civilian deaths to ensure that every reasonable step was taken to protect innocent lives. Kimberly Halkett, Al Jazeera, The White House.
All right, let's bring in our guests. From Washington, D.C., Wael Zayat, CEO of Engage Foundation. He was a senior policy advisor on Syria for the former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, and a Syria outreach coordinator for the U.S. Department of State. From Doha, Marwan Kabbalan, head of policy analysis at the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies. And from Pittsburgh, Colin Clark, senior research fellow at the Soufan Center and author of After the Caliphate, the Islamic State and the Future Terrorist Diaspora. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining us today on Inside Story. Colin, let me start with you today. You wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Times in which you said, although another Islamic State leader has been killed, the organization will endure in Iraq and Syria as long as the U.S. and its allies continue to substitute targeted killings for a more comprehensive counterterrorism strategy. What would that strategy look like?
Well, it's the same old talking points and issues that we hear all the time. It's investing in things like good governance and anti-corruption, the so-called soft side of counterterrorism, instead of strictly focusing on kinetic operations and taking out the head of these groups. It's a generational struggle. But when you go to Capitol Hill and you say, my strategy costs a lot of money, is going to take a really long time and there's no guarantee of success, you're shown the door pretty quickly. And so that's why there's an over-reliance, in my opinion, on high-value targeting.
Marwan, let me ask you, how much of a setback is Qureshi's death for ISIL? And is ISIL the sort of threat now that it was just a few years ago?
Well, it's indeed a setback, but as your guest from the Sofan Group has just mentioned, ISIL has always been able to replace one leader for another. And this can go on for forever unless you adopt some sort of a comprehensive approach to solving the problem of ISIL. The U.S. has somehow to get involved in nation building. You can't just go on like this, because just 2 years ago, ISIL has lost its historic leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and yesterday lost another leader. And I believe ISIL will be able to replace him pretty soon. This is something that I believe needs, more involvement by the United States in nation building, and that would entail not only good governance. Indeed, it's important, but also to deal with the grievances of the people in this part of the world, which the United States has contributed in some way or another. Don't forget, after all, that ISIL was the result of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the destruction of the Iraqi state. So we have a vacuum right now in somehow in the region, in Iraq and in Syria and many other places, also in the Middle East. And wherever there is a vacuum, ISIL will be able to replace, or some other form of jihadi groups will be able to fill that vacuum. So I think we need to have a comprehensive strategy to deal with the issue rather than keep actually going after leaders of ISIL one after another.
Well, you know, U.S. President Joe Biden took a lot of criticism for the U.S.'s withdrawal from Afghanistan, and many said that the way that that was handled was a sign that the U.S., as far as it was perceived globally, that it was really weakening. So I guess his administration would really see this as a way to send a message that the U.S. is still strong and reliable when it comes to counterterrorism. Do you think that's correct?
Thank you for having me. And to some degree, that is correct. It is a signal to not only to terrorist organizations, but also the international community, but that can only go so far. And I do agree with the gentleman before me. Really, you know, I joined Engage 5 years ago because we want to educate voters about the importance of human rights at home here in the United States and abroad. So what does that mean? It means that in places like Syria, where you have the regime of al-Assad and the family of Assad ruling one country for 40 years, have given and have invested really in the root causes of a situation that led to the production of a terrorist organization such as ISIS. And as long as those root causes of poor governance, gross human rights violations, and rampant corruption are really not addressed, and by the way, this is not only for the United States to fix. In fact, it is not. It is for the Syrian people and the regional countries to really tackle it. But the United States does happen to be a superpower. It is in Syria today. And I think it has an opportunity to invest in true support for people who are outside of government control, as well as put the pressures with its allies on the regime to either reform or really step aside, because we're going to keep repeating the cycle and we're going to be dealing and talking about ISIS 2.0, 3.0, and 4.0. And the people on the ground will pay the heaviest price.
Colin, you know, a few minutes ago, Marwan said that he believed that there could be a replacement for Qureshi as leader of ISIL relatively soon. Do you agree with that assessment? And also, how might Qureshi's death affect ISIL's global operations?
Yeah, well, we don't know how long it will take. And you know, the jockeying behind the scenes that's likely taking place right now, which is really interesting to think about and talk about. I mean, I've already been talking to other terrorism scholars this morning about the whole process and what's likely to happen next. In terms of global impact, that's another largely unknown, because it's still hard to verify exactly how much al-Qureshi was communicating on a regular basis, what the ISIS command and control structure looked like with the regional branches, affiliates, and franchise groups worldwide. Suffice to say, we know from history when the core or central group is unable to communicate with the branches for long periods of time, those branches tend to focus on local issues, not global issues. That was one of the big issues with Al-Qaeda in Iraq, you'll remember, with Zarqawi, the Jordanian militant. So there's a lot to keep an eye on in the next 3 to 6 months. There could be some real changes ahead for the Islamic State.
Marwan, from your vantage point, are there particular regional branches of ISIL or affiliates that would be more impacted by the death of Qureshi?
Yeah, probably Syria and Iraq. And don't forget that ISIL has always been keen on having its leader an Iraqi from Iraq mainly. So I think they might be have certain impact. But look, ISIL, in terms of territory, has been really defeated. So we are not looking here into something like a very strict hierarchical organization right now. It's rather loose one. And we can see actually branches of ISIL almost in, as the US says, in 37 countries now. And it's very difficult to think of it as being controlled by one top leadership located or actually acting from either out of Syria and Iraq. We see ISIL branches now in Mali, in Chad, in Niger, in many other African countries, in Asian countries as well. So I think this is a loose network right now, and they are mainly local fighters, and they are affiliating themselves somehow with ISIL because ISIL has a certain reputation. This is why I'm a little bit careful here about the impact of the elimination of the ISIL leader on the other branches in different countries.
Well, in January, there was this attempt, a rather brazen attempt by ISIL to break thousands of followers out of a prison in Hasakah in northeast Syria. This was a coordinated attack that lasted, as far as I know, for days. How much concern did that cause for the U.S., the fact that ISIL was able to do this, you know, and it was just a couple of years ago that ISIL was declared defeated?
Well, you know, that was a concern as far as back when I was working on the portfolio in the U.S. government. In 2017, as ISIS was on its way to being fully defeated, we warned, and even outside of government, that the ideology, as well as the diehard supporters of this ideology, were still in that Jazeera region, in the border region between Iraq and Syria, in northern Syria. And also remember, the grievances that they leveraged to enlist support from the local population. This is a really important point that you saw in Anbar province during the first insurgency in Iraq. They are able to leverage, you know, in some ways, legitimate grievances, whether it's Assad regime, Russia, or even the United States and their support for their SDF and the excesses of the Syrian Democratic Forces in places like Hasakah. So it raised a lot of concerns. The group is not fully eliminated. It retains the ability to conduct these kind of strikes. And also one thing to mention, there are thousands of former ISIS fighters and or their families, including minors, children, who are now still in detention after 3 years across detention facilities in the Northeast under the guard of U.S.-backed forces, the SDF. And, you know, one of the horrible situations of this recent prison break is hundreds of boys apparently were in that jail, and we believe many have been killed. And so that itself feeds into a new narrative of grievances on the part not only of ISIS diehards, but local populations that could feed new recruits into the future. So I think it's really a concern, and it requires a holistic approach to the immediate security situation, but as well as the underlying problems.
Colin, this strategy that we see enacted by the U.S., these decapitation strikes, where whether it's an air raid or a ground operation in which the leader of ISIL or other groups are taken out, and then they're able to, you know, reconstitute. I mean, how much impact really do they have on a group like ISIL? I mean, does this just become a cycle whereby, you know, the leader is killed or dies, and then somebody else takes their place, and then the whole cycle starts over again?
More or less. I mean, that's what we've been doing. I mean, you could use whatever cliche you want, whack-a-mole, or as the Israelis call it, mowing the lawn. A bit crude when you think about what we're doing, but accurate nonetheless. And I think, you know, the only thing I'd say is that not all leaders are created equal. And so you will have leaders that are more charismatic or better at recruiting and propaganda than others, some that are, you know, better strategists. But absolutely, the machinery of these organizations, the logistics logistics networks, the financing, the propaganda, all of these things have been built over time, and they're extremely difficult, if not impossible, to dismantle, particularly if you're, you know, just talking about removing leaders. You also have the issue of intel gain loss, which is the devil you know versus the devil you don't. The more you remove leaders, you know, the less intelligence you have on who's coming up the pike next. And those leaders that ultimately come up, you know, the leadership pipeline may actually be more radical than those that they supplanted. So that's a concern, too.
Marwan, I just want to try to take a step back for a moment and look at the bigger picture here, especially in the region. I mean, one of the things that this raid has done is it has refocused attention on Syria. And so I just want to ask you, what is the overall situation there right now?
Well, I think there is some kind of a deadlock in Syria right now, because, as you know, of course, I mean, the major battle has actually ceased to we don't have major confrontations right now in Syria, but we don't have a political process as well. So the fault lines are more or less fixed over the past 2 years, especially since the agreement, the Sochi agreement between President Erdogan of Turkey and President Putin of Russia, especially in Idlib, where this is where the leader of ISIL was eliminated a couple of days ago. So the situation right now is the country is, in fact, you can describe the whole picture as is getting dismantled by the hour. Why? Because we have a very difficult, harsh economic conditions. We have several authorities in several places. We have the situation of the people actually under regime or under opposition is deteriorating by the day. You can actually see how people are affected by the harsh winter these days, without having actually enough food supplies and other basic needs. So I think the situation is really dire. And this is where I think the role of the United States is important. Mm. The United States right now, this is what we have been talking about perhaps for some time now. Mm-hmm. The United States is mainly concerned right now about actually supplying certain humanitarian aid to the Syrian people, mm-hmm. and eliminating ISIL. So the very narrow vision, I believe, in dealing with the Syrian conflict is actually putting us in this vicious circle, mm-hmm. Because the United States want to alleviate the responsibility somehow, or to take off the burden from its shoulders, mm-hmm. by saying, well, we're actually helping the Syrians by providing them with humanitarian aid. On the other hand, we are actually after ISIL, and we are trying actually to weaken it. But other than that, the Americans are not doing what they need to do, which is the political process. That is the issue here. That is the thing that we need to look at. Because as long as this conflict goes on, and as long as the situation is deteriorating of the people, we will have more people actually joining ISIL. There will be the recruitment process for ISIL will be easier, because the grievances we have been talking about, mm-hmm. and the very difficult conditions. Because look, ISIL relies very much on two main elements.
Marwan, I'm sorry. Marwan, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're just starting to run out of time. Wael, I want to ask you about, well, from your perch there in Washington, D.C., I mean, do you see this playing out advantageously for President Biden? You know, former President Obama, he ordered the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. Former President Trump ordered the raid in which Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi died. Does this help Biden? Does it help him domestically in the U.S., and does it help the way he's perceived internationally?
Look, it's not going to hurt him, and it will likely help him in the short term. But right now, the American population in general, I mean, most don't know who Qureshi is, really. And they are focused on the inflation situation in the United States, the high prices for consumer goods. And so as we get closer to the midterm elections, I think this operation will recede into the memory of the American population. And I don't think there'll be a big impact for him electorally. However, I think from a prestige, from you know, within the foreign policy circles, people who track these, you know, these issues. Yes. But again, even within those circles, whether here and abroad, people will always be asking the question, what is the United States doing strategically to alleviate the situation in Syria, to stabilize the situation in Syria, and to help? And by the way, again, not only the United States to do, but with its allies and the region to address the root causes of this conflict. And I would say that even though there is now a de facto semi-stable situation in Syria, there's a deadlock, as it was just mentioned, there are some factors that may change it. Right now, we'll see what happens with the Ukraine and Russia situation. Second, the negotiations with Iran over its Iranian nuclear deal. Third, the deteriorating economic situation in Syria and in Iran, which could hamper the regime's efforts to hold on to areas that it controls already. And fourth, the midterm elections, obviously, what happens here electorally with the United States, because clearly we're not staying there forever. So it's just a matter of time. And what is going to drive the administration to make that decision?
Colin, I saw you nodding along to some of what Wael was saying there. Did you want to jump in?
I just think we don't have a serious strategy. And will Biden, you know, get a boost from this decapitation strike? Yeah, temporarily. But he's got to do it again and again and again. And if he actually wants to make any progress, it's got to be connected to some broader strategy, which we just lack. We're pretty rudderless in terms of foreign policy. And we have little leverage in Syria and Afghanistan. So, look at the major players in Syria, Iran, Russia. The United States is, you know, one of several parties. And it's clear that, the Turks are and others that, you know, there's no clear and coherent game plan or blueprint for how to operate in the Middle East. The U.S. is desperate to get out of the Middle East and quote unquote pivot to Asia, but keeps getting dragged back in. And again, without a kind of broader grand strategy or even a regional strategy, we're going to end up in the same situation.
Marwan, we only have a couple of minutes left. Let me just ask you, you know, ISIL's previous leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, he was much more well-known than al-Qureshi. He was considered more charismatic. He was, analysts say he was able to recruit more people and inspire more people. The fact that al-Qureshi was less visible, that he had a lower profile, did that make it more difficult for ISIL to spread its propaganda and inspire recruits?
I'm not sure about that, Mohammed, because as your other guests actually mentioned, as long as we have the conditions that is helping ISIL to recruit people, we are going to have actually more people joining ISIL unless we deal with the conditions that are producing the sort of conditions that we are dealing with right now in Syria and in Iraq. In both countries, actually, there are so many grievances, local grievances in particular, that are pushing certain people actually to join ISIL. Of course, Amir al-Baghdadi was much more charismatic because, as you know, the reason for that, he defeated the Iraqi army in Mosul and he declared the Khilafah, and you know all the details. This is why he was more like an influential leader of ISIL. But as I said, this is not about the leadership of ISIL. It's more about the conditions that are producing ISIL time and again.
All right. Well, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the discussion there. Thanks so much to all of our guests, Wael El-Zayat, Marwan Kabalan, and Colin Clark. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here, bye for now.